Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is New La La, Money Made Simple. You've been scrolling through social media. You've seen, I'm sure, ridiculous things like a $700 hair dryer, shoes, headphones, makeup products. These are just a few of the things that someone with a large following on social media might have been trying to influence you to buy. Now, some TikTok users are calling out consumerism with a new trend called de-influencing. Alicia Adamczyk is a senior writer at Fortune. She's going to talk more about this counter trend. Then, you're looking to invest in green funds like ESG kind of stuff? It could cost you. Mark Egan is an associate professor at Harvard Business School, and he co-authored a study on ESG funds. He'll be here to talk about what you are getting for what you are paying. And if you're a Canadian who has moved to the U.S. or maybe back from the U.S., you could have some cross-border complexity in your investing. Managing those financial advisors can come with some pretty unique challenges. Shiraz Ahmed is a wealth management advisor, founder of the Sartorial Wealth Team. He'll talk about how to work around and avoid some border blunders. Then in times of economic uncertainty, a lot of people look at alternative ways to save money. When it comes to funerals, it's no different. You can save money there too. It's just people don't want to talk about it. Well, today we're going to talk about it. Mallory Green is the CEO of a new online cremation and end-of-life technology platform. That's a mouthful. We're going to talk about the cost of cremation on the show today. Plus, I'll speak with the author of My Dad's Class, Paige Cornetet. She'll bring us some lessons on talking to your kids about money. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. We live in the age of the influencer. If you spend any time at all on social media, you have been inundated with influencers posting about products and encouraging people to buy them, sometimes overtly, sometimes subtly. But some users, social media users on TikTok in particular, are getting tired of this consumer culture and this relentless move to try and get us to buy stuff. They are doing the exact opposite. It's called de-influencing. Alicia Adamczyk is a senior writer at Fortune. She wrote a piece on this idea. She joins us now from New York. Hello there.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What exactly is a de-influencer? It sounds like a buzzkill. It sounds like the raining on the parade at the party.
Well, you know, I wouldn't put it that way. To be honest, I think they're tapping into like a very real fatigue people are having. You know, if anything, influencers might be becoming buzzkills at this point. I think so. People are just getting very tired of being sold to in every single video or post they look at. And what a de-influencer is doing is basically saying, you know, hey, you actually don't need X product that is very popular at the moment on this app, or hey, maybe we should have a conversation about sustainability and being a little more, you know, conscious about what it is we're buying and paying attention to.
And it was TikTok where this first began, is that right?
So it first began on TikTok for sure. But I think on a lot of social media sites, this topic really resonates. Like, I remember a few years ago on YouTube, another, you know, video platform, it was called like anti-hauls, like, so anti having like huge drops of products that you were kind of talking about. So it's definitely something.
H-A-U-L-S.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Like U-Haul. So got it.
Definitely resonates. Yeah.
And can you describe what one of these, but you know, we're on the radio, so we can't watch the TikTok video, but what would one of those posts look or sound like? Would they be a direct call out to people to say, stop doing this? Or would they be funny? Would they be soundtracks? What would we see?
Yeah, well, it could be any of the above. The ones I've really seen is, you know, really in like the beauty and skincare space. And, you know, a creator will just straight to camera kind of be like, I'm going to tell you five products you don't need to buy because they're bad. And here are those products. And that's what I've seen a lot of. But I've also seen like similar ones where it's a much more general conversation about like consumer habits, you know, broadly. So
my Pollyanna deluded optimist would love to say this will have a significant impact on the buying patterns of the generation that is so loyal, let's say, not addicted, let's say loyal to social media. Are you more cynical than me?
I don't want to be more cynical. I also want to believe that this might give people kind of, you know, a check a little bit of, oh, hey, wait, maybe I don't need these things. I just think it's become so normalized, especially on TikTok. Like you open a comment section and every other comment is, where did you get this? Where did you get, you know, that? And the video doesn't even necessarily have to be about a product. So I think any sort of pushback against that, just like instinct people have now to just buy, like I think is great, honestly.
We, you know, my background was in marketing. And so there was a very traditional way to reach consumers back in the day. You bought a TV ad. And in these times, the influencers really are the conduit to the consumer. Has their growth surprised you? I mean, I look at it because I'm older. I look at it and think, really, how many people are making a living, you know, showing off a cute pair of boots?
I wonder that too. It does surprise me that there are seemingly so many people who make livings this way or are able to leave their jobs. Then again, you know, a lot of these people that at least I see are very young. And so maybe, you know, it's not like a long-term sustainable move, but it's a move for a couple years as they figure out what's next. But I agree with you that it does seem like overwhelming the amount of people who can kind of, you know, make a living this way.
Can you shed some light on how this works? Because as I read your article, there's some things I didn't know, like this link trees process where creators can provide these links in a super easy way, making it practically one click.
Yeah. So what these are is, you know, so again, I'm only like kind of speaking from what I see, like my algorithm, but a woman, let's say, might be going about her day and someone will ask, hey, I loved your bedding. Where did you get that? And she says, it's in my link tree. So if you go to her bio, her TikTok page, you click on like the link tree and every single thing in the video is linked into where you can buy it. The bedding, cups, mugs, kitchen accessories, like pretty much anything you want is linked there, you know? So it makes everything just extremely easy for people to find and buy, you know, if that's what they want.
And in fairness to the influencer trend, magazines have done that for decades where you'd flip through Architectural Digest or Cosmopolitan or whatever, and they would have the products listed at the back. So I think we should probably acknowledge that is a connection isn't completely new. But there was another term that I hadn't heard, or a phrase, there's a dupe for that. What does that mean?
Well, so it's interesting you bring up the magazine thing, right? Because I think a lot of people will say, well, we're just making it more accessible to people, right? We are doing cheaper things that are more affordable than what you'll find in a more high-end magazine. And that really comes through in the sort of dupe culture, which apparently is, you know, like duplicate, right? So if you see something from West Elm, a couch, but you can't afford that, a dupe might be a much cheaper couch from Amazon that kind of looks the same and gives you the same sort of aesthetic. And that's really proliferated on the app.
Fascinating. Do you take any steps in your own social media consumption to reduce the influence, pun intended, that those influencers have on how you spend your money?
I do. I think it's very easy to fall into, and I was kind of getting frustrated with it. Now, you know, when videos crop up where every, you know, if a person in the video is kind of naming every single product, I, you know, you can say not interested. So I try to do that for those videos, or I just try not to interact with them anymore. So hopefully TikTok is like, oh, I guess she doesn't want these. I think also just in my life though, it's a lot broader than that, right? Like I make a list of things I'm tempted to buy. I wait on it. I go back. I usually don't want those things anymore, right? It's always very like in the moment.
Delayed gratification. How's that for a vintage find? Delayed gratification. Alicia, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Alicia Demchak is a senior writer at Fortune, and she joined us to talk about de-influencing. So we know these influencers are everywhere on social media. Some of them are coming out and saying, hey, how about no? How about we don't spend all of that money on all of those things?
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Talking about death and what follows afterwards can be very, very, very difficult for people. A part of that is talking about the financial aspect, right? Like funerals, burials, cremation. They all can be expensive services, but so often the purchase decision is made at the time of great stress, and it can feel like honoring your loved one means buying a package maybe you can't afford. To talk about the costs of some of these expenses and some alternatives, we're joined by Mallory Green. She is the CEO and co-founder of Irene, an online cremation and end-of-life platform. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Online cremation and end-of-life technology platform. What does that mean?
You know, I like to think of us as a modern funeral home. There are still obviously the operational things happening on the back end. We have to pick up your loved one and transfer them and actually proceed with either the cremation or the burial. But from the arrangement process, we are online. So you can make arrangements with Irene by phone, or you can do it entirely self-serve on our website. And the main reason for that is that, as you've just described, families are often grieving, they're stressed, there's a lot going on after you lost someone. Mm-hmm. And so the requirement to be in person the first thing after you've lost someone and fill out a bunch of paperwork and just do everything face-to-face, we didn't feel is a reasonable ask of grieving families. So we really have brought the funeral industry into the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. And that ask has been, as old as time. You always had to go in person to do those
right.
Sorts of things.
I think it's what everyone thinks about when you think of a funeral home. You think of movie theater carpeting, very old school, traditional, maybe a suit from the 70s. Yeah. I mean, it's just what we all think about, right? Yeah. But times are changing and consumers' needs are changing.
Now, there is some physicality to a funeral home, because the ones I've been to, they have maybe chapels, they've got visitation rooms, they do all those sorts of things. If you're online, mm-hmm. Is someone able to book a physical place for a visitation or a celebration of life? Or how does that dynamic? How does that
yeah,
element work?
Very good question. So today, about 72% of Canadians choose cremation as their final disposition. And the reason for that is because it's way more flexible in terms of how you memorialize someone. So we're not necessarily always now having actual memorial services within the funeral home. People are kind of choosing more unique memorials. So whether that's at a park or a museum or something that reflects that person that they are memorializing. So Irene really focuses on the initial decision that has to be made, which is you choose cremation, you choose burial, or in some provinces, there's something called alkaline hydrolysis, which is a water-based cremation. And so that decision has to be made relatively quickly after someone has passed away. And so we're focused on that and then providing families with the tools to then decide how they memorialize someone on their own terms.
And this part is morbid. So that someone comes to pick up your loved one and take them somewhere. Is that an Irene employee, or is that a service that you provide in addition to other things?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So our model is different in every province that we serve, but the easiest way to describe the funeral industry is that it's a 24/7 essential service, and there's essentially different players that exist within it. So there's funeral homes, there's crematoriums, there's cemeteries, and then there's something called transfer services. And transfer services are often working for many funeral homes to, as you said, kind of move the deceased throughout the province and get them to their final disposition. And so essentially what Irene has done is we have skipped over the need for a physical funeral home, and we've gone straight to these partner providers that other funeral homes would utilize. So for example, in Ontario, we have about 10 different partners throughout the province. And in each new province we go into, we establish new partners that help us kind of run on the operational side. But what that allows us to do is keep our costs down, because we don't have the high overhead of a physical funeral home. We can actually charge about half the cost of a traditional funeral home.
Right. I'm making a poor analogy to food delivery, and I don't mean to be flippant about it, but some restaurants, and especially in the olden days, used to have a driver who would deliver just for that restaurant. And now we have Uber Eats, where it is a different human in a vehicle that can deliver for many, many different restaurants. Is that a fair comparison?
Exactly. And I think overall, the goals of all of these services is to bring down costs for the business, but also bring down costs for the consumer.
So the buckets that you talked about, there is funeral, burial, cremation. In a traditional model, what is the ballpark cost on those three things? And through Irene, what is the ballpark cost on those three things?
Yes. So the average funeral, which we would guess would be kind of more traditional burial with the memorial service, would be about $10,000 to $20,000 in Canada today. A direct cremation, which is what Irene offers, the average cost across Canada is about $5,000. So Irene is $2,500 plus tax, so about 50% of that. The thing with the cost of funerals is that it, whether burial or cremation, it ranges so drastically that you could walk in a different door of a building and it would be the same business. Maybe they have a discount business and it will be a totally different price. And the reason for that is there's very little pricing transparency that currently exists in funeral services.
It's so similar to my perception of how the wedding industry works, in that it's a room. They're serving you dinner and you're having a moment at the front of a room, but it's not that different from renting a conference room for a business. It's just as soon as you go down and call it a wedding, there's a whole different price menu offered.
Right. And you know what? The interesting thing about weddings that I was recently thinking about is it's very similar to the wedding industry in terms of how we have traditionally memorialized people, with which is generally we've always thought the more you spend on a wedding, the more you love that person and maybe your relationship is going to last forever. And it's very similar in the funeral industry, which is there's a lot of guilt involved with how you're memorializing and really like money spent equals love shown. But I think both industries are moving away from that concept. People can choose how to memorialize or how to have a wedding in whatever way that they see fit. And it doesn't reflect that love.
Now, give me a sense for how you're able to provide the cremation service at such a discount. I have two hypotheses, but I'll let you go first.
I'm very curious to hear the hypotheses, but no, I think honestly, the big reason that funeral services have increased, the cost of them have increased by about 35% over the past, I think 15 years, is because of the cost of real estate. These big traditional funeral homes have very high overhead. They have vehicles and Cadillacs and mortgages and all of these things that do add to the cost. There's also obviously very high margins in funeral services. So you could argue that our margins just aren't as high. But really what we're doing is we're utilizing technology to pass on savings to families. So on the back end side that the family doesn't actually even see, our licensed funeral directors are using tools and technology that we have built as a business to make their jobs easier. So there's not, if you go into a funeral home, sometimes you will see that they're filling out paperwork endlessly, the same information repeatedly. We just don't do that. Like, we've automated all of the back end, which also, once again, can keep our costs down.
There are some categories that have proven to be very, very difficult to move to an online world. Wills have been very tough for people. Real estate has been very tough for people. My sense is that it's tough for people to change these cultural habits about what the right thing to do is for funerals and for cremation. How do you crack that? How do you crack the consumer behavior that is generations old?
That is a very good question. And I think that is a total work in progress, but I do believe that as generations change, I mean, our target market are Gen Xers who are making arrangements for their parents. And I think they have just a total different expectation, one of how they interact with services. And I mean, as you said, we can order food on our phone and get it within 30 minutes. Like, there's just a total different expectation. I know personally, if I have to call my internet provider, like, that's like the worst part of my day. So there's just generally, we want different services and in different ways. And so I think big part of it is just like society's expectation. But yeah, it's very interesting how it's evolving. I mean, when we got our very first family who chose to utilize us. I was like, this is so wild that we could, within a few days of launching our business, someone would trust us enough. And I think it's just been kind of the reputation that we've built over time and this like network effect of people referring business. And we still, despite being an online business, there is always going to be a human element to our business. We have licensed funeral directors. You can speak to them 24/7. We have the best people in the industry on our team. Just so happens to be like 95% women on our team. But I think generally there's still that human element, and we never want people to lose sight of that with Irene. Like, we're really focused on compassion, but we think that you can provide high quality services and still have a fair price.
I can imagine it's harder for my parents' generation to even conceive of this. Because when I think about the wills that I've come in contact with, or those family members that I know, they name the funeral home. And that funeral home's probably been on that same plot of land for 50 or 100 years.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting what we're finding now, because of the people who are often choosing our services, Gen Xers and even millennials, we call them influencers in our business. They're obviously maybe a bit more far removed from the death most often. So they are kind of guiding the family through the decision of who to choose. We are finding people saying to us, my family for the past, as you said, 50 years has gone to this one funeral home, and we're switching it up. And I actually don't know why that is, but I think it is just how Irene speaks to people. It's that we're honest, we're affordable, and we just make a really difficult time a little bit easier on families. Like, that's really what we're focused on. So there is definitely a total shift happening. And I would say, like, the oldest person that has chosen to use Irene, he was, I think, 102.
Wow.
And he actually fully was comfortable online. So, yeah. I mean, it's just a changing world, right?
Yeah. One last question. As you look globally, would assume other countries are making similar inroads into innovating these industries that are old. Which countries are leading the push in your space in particular?
That is a really great question. You know, I think what's interesting is if you look globally, there are some countries who are 100% cremation. And when I think about leading the push, I think about how can we sustain our current funeral practices? Because the answer is we cannot. I mean, a lot of cemeteries are running out of space. If you look at London in the UK, I think it's 10 years or so, they'll be fully out of cemetery space. And so when I think about leaders in the space, like, Japan is 100% cremation rate. And I do think that what will naturally occur from that push to cremation is more environmentally sustainable options. And actually, the interesting part about that is that in the US, there's way more sustainable options that currently exist for Americans. So it's interesting. Like the globally, there's always going to be ways to memorialize people and what's considered culturally appropriate. But there are some things that are happening globally that there has to be changes. Like, we can't actually sustain what we're currently doing within funeral services.
Very interesting stuff. Mallory, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mallory Green is the CEO and co-founder of Irene, which I now understand what an online cremation and end-of-life technology platform actually is, because she explained it so well. It's a whole new world out there. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, I'm going to speak to the author of a book called My Dad's Class. Her name is Paige Cornett. She's got some activities that you can do to help kids learn more about money and about life. And later, avoiding border blunders. Wealth management advisor Shiraz Ahmed shares his tips for managing cross-border investments. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, sign up to our newsletter. It features all the stuff that we do here on SiriusXM, plus CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg and all that stuff. Just go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. Kids, being a parent is a really big trip. And as someone who focuses so much on personal finance, I think a lot about how I am impressing those lessons upon my child. We had a conversation with Paige Coronet about her book. I can't even remember what it was, a while ago. The book is called My Dad's Class, An Intentional Structure for Teaching Your Kids About Money and Life. And we decided to have her back. So Paige has joined us again. We're going to talk about some of the lesson activities. And I love them because they are so, so clear. Paige, welcome back. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you. I so appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Bruce.
So I think we should start by having you kind of frame this in the context of your book, My Dad's Class. What's the essence of that book?
The essence of the book is an intentional structure, how to teach your family and your kids about life and money, because they go hand in hand. It's not just about money.
And where did you get this wisdom yourself?
Well, I grew up with parents who were crystal clear of how they were going to raise us. And my dad did every Saturday a dad's class where we learned about the economy and business and all these different, lessons that he gave to us. And my mom's class was every day, but dad's class was intentionally Saturdays.
Now, surely you went through a gestation in your feelings about these classes. Like, you must have started with, I'm oblivious that every family doesn't do this, to no other family does this and this is ridiculous and it must stop, to oh my God, I'm so grateful, this was really helpful. Are those the three phases? Did I characterize them correctly?
Absolutely. I would say from 1 to 18, I was like oblivious, no one else did this. College, I was like, oh, nobody does this. Right. And now that I have my own family in my 30s, I'm like, okay, I'm really grateful for it.
Yeah, let's do this. Okay, so I have linked to one of the teaching guide things that I want to focus on. It's chapter 2, Lay Down the Law. It's about preparing for family laws. What is a family law?
So in my family, we had peace, asking, order, respect, and obedience. Those were our five family laws. And as a child, it was the consequences of if you did something. For example, peace, number one, if you disrupted the peace within yourself and within the family, you needed to go to the repenting bench and kind of have, thoughts about how I disrupted the peace. And it was kind of bigger than yourself. So there was the consequences behind the family laws.
Wow. I thought I grew up in a family with a strong culture. Yours is like 10x mind. It's amazing. So in this outline, you've got goals, you've got essential questions on the laws, you've got some videos, and then you've got, it's called Let's Talk. What's the conversation that you're trying to catalyze on that topic in particular?
Well, I think for the parents to come together first and the spouses to have those sort of conversations, and obviously age appropriate with the children, but really, I think the ultimate thing that my family did was having us sit down and have these conversations and explain to us, well, whether we were five, whether we were seven, whether we were 17, what that word meant and what these laws meant and how it could help us in our life and as kind of the ecostructure of the family.
And so you've got Let's Watch, Let's Talk, Let's Do. What's an example of the doing that kids would take on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so with peace, we'll go back to peace again, the repenting bench, something that you would do is you would sit on this hard spot and repent with the sibling that you hit or whatever happened, and then you would have to come together to talk to the parent and explain your side. So no matter what, even if you were the one hitting or being hit, you were still a part of the problem. And so realizing, your actions have consequences. consequences within it. And so it's doing the consequences and understanding and the repetition behind it too.
The other lesson, this is chapter one, create out loud family saying. So what was your, I've just got ready to roll my eyes. I'm going to love what you say. I'm going to roll my eyes. This is in the very same facial expression. What was an out loud family saying when you were growing up?
Number one was, I can do it.
Wow. Mine would have been, life's not fair. That would have been mine. That would have been mine, but different. Okay. All right. And so in this teaching guide, you've got, again, let's watch, let's talk. What are the, what's the conversation with kids about that?
Well, again, age appropriate, right? So if you're going through your family sayings like, I can do it, do what's right, do your best, we would pretend that we were superstars and put our hands in the air and jump up and down and say, I can do it, and scream it from the mountaintops to really help emphasize it within our body and within our mouths.
And the specific, the real actionable part of this chapter is around routines. And I want to draw a very emphatic link here between routines and personal finance, because so much of what we're trying to teach our kids is just habits. Having good habits like brushing your teeth, they will serve you for a lifetime. So what are some routines that you would recommend families take on that would make a difference when it comes to money?
I would say the number one thing that my family did was family bank. And that was every Saturday, our family bank opened and we earned money from however old we were. So if I was seven, I earned $7. And then you were able to put it in the family bank and ledger it and understand, okay, this is consistent weekly. We're doing a family bank and our bank opens and we can have conversations around it. And this was up until I left the house when I was 18. Wow.
What role did guilt or judgment play in this? You smiled immediately when I said that. I ask because it's families, but also religions and geographic cultures, like all different layers of culture, have different dynamics around these sorts of things. Were your parents able to keep it pure, or would they, you know, give you the stink eye if you withdrew money from the family bank and went and blew it at the casino?
I think it depended on which parent, honestly. Oh.
So, okay, I love to hear they're not perfect. So who was right? The higher guilt-oriented person? I have a hypothesis.
I would say, she's not going to like me saying this, but my mother was more of the guilt, like, are you sure you want to buy those $100 jeans?
Jeans, but you know, there are children dying in Africa. So, right, you know, just because you buy those $100 jeans.
Exactly. So there was a lot of questions of like the underlying tone being like, are you sure? Think about it. But overall, my parents did a good job at letting us as kids handle the money and make those mistakes and have those conversations. And maybe they weren't even mistakes to us. So, you know, $100 jeans that maybe I still have, probably don't fit into them, but.
My kid is 13. And certainly if I reflect on the choices that I have made as a parent, there are some things I would 1000% do exactly the same. Some one or two things that I might do differently. Have you ever asked your parents, as it related to these classes and in particular around personal finance, what they might do differently if they had a do-over?
That's a great question. And I have never, and I'm going to call them after talking to you. What would you have done differently? Especially because I just became a parent. So I would love to hear, you know, how would you do it differently? Or if you would, what would you do differently?
Yeah. Cause I think part of the reason my family culture was so strong was because there were five kids. And if you didn't, you had two choices. You either chose a chaotic household or a household with laws and routines and structure, or the parents would lose their ever loving minds.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
What is the one thing? Now your kid is young. Yes.
She is 5 months.
Five. Six. That is young. That is young. So are you already like when you, you know, cuckoo into her ear and sing her a little lullaby, does it have lyrics that relate to retirement savings? Are you starting that early?
How'd you know? We say money, save money, spend money. Daily, weekly, monthly.
Is there anything that you think you will not reapply?
I would say there was a very, my dad was strict, and I would say that I won't be as strict as it. I will be firm, but kind. I think kindness is important. with it, but I will not be as firm as he was.
Yes, said with love. Well, yes. Very helpful. I love that we had a chance to get into these lessons. Paige, thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Paige Coronetit, and the book is My Dad's Class, An Intentional Structure for Teaching Your Kids About Money and Life. And these lessons that we've talked about are available online. Paige, where are they available online? Because I see I've got a link here. Where are they? Where can people find them?
SpendThen.com, THEN, SpendThen.com.
SpendThen.com. Okay, that's where you will find them. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to wealth management advisor Shiraz Ahmed about the challenges people face when they're managing cross-border investment accounts. But first, the cost people are willing to pay for green funds. Mark Egan from Harvard Business School talks about a study that he co-authored on the value of ESG. Want some more Moolala? You can head on over to moolala.ca and listen to past episodes. When you look at episodes on the website, you can look at them by topic, by guest name. You can also go to the various podcast platforms out there and download episodes, also subscribe. You could even write a review of the show, which would help more people discover it.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
ESG, a big acronym in lots of different areas, but investing too, environmental, social, and governance. And investing in companies and in funds that focus on ESG is a big hot trend. Looking at performance maybe isn't something that people focus on as much as the feel-good aspect of going green. And we're going to talk about that and the fee structure and the return on some of these funds. Mark Egan is an associate professor of finance at the Harvard Business School. He co-authored a study on this very question. He joins us now from Boston to talk about his findings. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Now, it is an easy conceptual sell for ESG. Like, you want to make the world a better place, amazing, put your money where your mouth is and invest. How would you characterize the benefits of ESG funds to investors?
So they provide, and what we show in our paper, a relatively, I think, low-cost way to sort of tilt your portfolio towards companies that rank high in terms of ESG. And when I say they're is relatively cost-effective in the sense that on average, investors pay roughly 5 basis points more to invest in an ESG fund relative to like an equivalent non-ESG fund.
Right. And the fund dynamic in Canada is different insofar as everything's more expensive here. It's certainly actively traded funds are more than in the US. Passively traded ETFs can be more expensive here. But tell us more about what the focus of your study was. What question were you trying to answer?
You know, if you've been following the financial media at all for the past few years, we've heard lots of talks at the corporate and at financial institutions about ESG being important. And it's sort of predicated on this idea that investors care about ESG, which, you know, as you sort of led in, makes sense. But what we look at in the study is, well, are investors really willing to put their money where their mouth is? And how much are they willing to really pay for ESG? So what we do is look at the study, especially in the US, there's been the growth of ESG index funds. And by studying flows into and out of these ESG index funds relative to non-ESG index funds, we can measure how much investors are willing to pay for ESG. And what we find is investors are willing to pay about roughly 10 basis points more, or starting in 2019, we're willing to pay roughly 10 basis points or maybe 20% more for ESG funds relative to non-ESG funds. And that's actually grown almost three times over the past 3 years. So we find most recently investors are willing to pay roughly 30 basis points more per annum for ESG.
And when you say they're willing to pay that, is that that the market prices those ESG funds at 20 to 30% with a 20 to 30% premium?
No, that's a great question. So what we find is actually, even though investors are willing to pay 30 basis points more for ESG, because the index fund market is relatively competitive in the US, investors only end up paying roughly 5 basis points more for an ESG fund. So they value it at roughly 30 basis points. They only pay 5 basis points. So that net 25 basis point is just a gain to ESG investors.
And to what do you attribute that attitudinal difference? Marketing? Great marketing on the future of our planet?
Well, if you just look in terms of the growth of just the introduction of new ESG funds has grown roughly tripled over the past 3 years. So I think it's just investors, growing interest by investors and wanting to really put their, invest their dollars with their values.
You also looked at the makeup of some of these ESG funds in terms of what was pure, you know, that would really easily fit, like a wind farm. That's easy to call an ESG project, and others that are, you know, scratch your head a little bit as to whether they should be included in there. What insight can you provide us on, I don't know, the spectrum of companies that qualify to be put inside an ESG fund?
That is a great point. So one thing you might have in mind when you invest in an ESG fund is basically you get like some portfolio that is very different from the market as a whole that is just focused on ESG funds. But what we find in our study is actually if you compare like a S&P 500 fund with the S&P 500 like ESG version of that fund, they actually end up holding a lot of the same stuff. So the portfolio overlap is roughly 60%. Which means that you're paying roughly, I said 5 basis points more for ESG, but that you might want to, that you actually effectively are paying slightly more than that because you only get like a 40% additional ESG exposure when you switch from an S&P 500 fund to an S&P 500 ESG fund, if that makes sense.
And, you know, the headline in the Wall Street Journal was pretty, I don't know, controversial, maybe not the right word, but it was green funds cost three times more than you think. Tell us what the article is referencing when it talks about your study and that headline.
Yeah. So like, as we mentioned that you pay five basis points more for ESG funds, but you might think that given that a lot of what an ESG fund holds, like a regular non-ESG fund holds the exact same or a similar set of companies, you might want to scale that fee you pay, that 5 basis points, by roughly a factor of 3. If you want to think about like how much you're actually paying for every dollar that goes into ESG companies that wouldn't have gone into ESG companies had you just invested in the S&P 500.
Right. So you've done all this work. You come at it from an academic perspective. Your graduate works in finance. You're presumably a numbers person. Would you say you are skeptical, having done all this work, about the value proposition for ESG funds?
I would say that is like a very good question. There's like one thing we can't say in this study of is whether or not the value investors place on ESG, how much of that's ultimately passed on to these ESG companies in terms of lower cost of capital. But what I can say sort of in defense of these ESG funds is even though investors are willing to pay 30 basis points, they only end up paying roughly 5 basis points more per annum, which I think I consider relatively small if you think about sort of the scope of fees that investors pay for index funds and mutual funds in general. So I would say in some sense, the cost of investing in ESG was less than what I expected it to be sort of going into this study.
And what is, if we layer in performance here, what have you learned about relative performance? Because in different asset classes, like I don't know what it is in the US, but in Canada, if you have a broad-based large cap equity fund, the MER is probably going to be lower than if it's something more niche, like a small cap or just lower assets under management. What did you learn about performance on ESG? Because I'm sure many people would love to believe that these funds will outperform something more traditional over time.
So we find some very modest evidence that ESG funds over the past 3 years have slightly outperformed non-ESG funds. But I'm going to heavily caveat that you know, with 3, 4, or 5 years of data, you just don't really have enough time to say that ESG funds are outperforming non-ESG funds. So if you're doing this based on how little data we have on ESG versus non-ESG, you really can't look at historical returns and try to extrapolate that going forward to make your investment decision.
It's also interesting because you'd have to factor in consumer sentiment, which has been negative on energy and positive on, I'm going to use my wind farms, just to use the cliche there. So that's about sentiment and maybe the ability to command a higher multiple than it is about, wow, these companies make more money just because they're better at governance and dealing with the environment.
Exactly.
I was expecting a little bit of a comment.
I mean, I completely agree with you. Like we just don't have quite enough data. Like it's very difficult to measure performance from past returns. And given that, I mean, these index funds, ESG index funds have grown in popularity over the past 3 years. We just don't have a big enough sample yet to say that they've really outperformed or underperformed relative to their non-ESG equivalents.
Very interesting stuff. Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Mark Egan is an associate professor of finance at the Harvard Business School, and he joined us to talk about a study he co-authored on really the value of ESG funds. And certainly there is an enormous conceptual benefit. And for many investors, that is worth any delta in cost there is, because they believe in this, and other people have a more skeptical take on all that. Stay with us. Coming up, the challenges you might encounter if you are someone with investment accounts on both sides of the Canada-US border.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Fighting a border blunder. If you are someone with investment accounts on both sides of the Canada-US border, there can be some challenges you may face when it comes to managing your money. Shiraz Ahmed is founder of the Sartorial Wealth Team, part of Raymond James. He and his team specialize in these cross-border financial matters. He joins us from Toronto. Hello.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
I'm good. What sort of circumstances would have people hold investments in both countries?
So that's a great question. And it really comes down to a lot of just life. So people tend to move quite a bit over that border. So I'd say the first one is individuals or families moving on either direction over the border. Another one that happens is people inheriting wealth over the border, which unfortunately does happen more often than not. And I think we could all probably throw a stone and find someone that we know or a close loved one that is American and or Canadian if you're on the US side. So our two countries are intertwined, and I think this is just living proof of that.
Mm. I used to live and work in the US, and so I still have a retirement savings account from when I lived and worked in the US, like, I don't know, 20 years ago or something. What are some of the challenges that people experience or may experience if they've got accounts in two countries?
So that's a pretty loaded question. And I'd say I'd try to boil it down to kind of one major simplified statement, which is I think a lot of individuals and professionals tend to assume that the rules are the same on both sides of the border, which while we may share one of the world's largest land borders, our systems and tax situations couldn't be more different. So I think that's probably the biggest challenge that people end up facing is they just assume, or they've anecdotally read something somewhere where, you know, one thing worked for one person and that's definitely going to be the case for me, or they just, you know, end up assuming that, you know, that's the rule of my current circumstance. I should be able to do the exact same thing over the border, which often is not the case.
When it comes to actually managing those investments, so either directing a financial advisor in another country or using a self-directed, you know, discount brokerage platform in a new country, are there restrictions or can you do whatever you want?
There are, unfortunately, restrictions. So, and a lot of them is actually not so much on the individual. So people can move freely, of course, assuming they get visas and whatnot to be in whatever country that they want to be in. But the wealth management component of it is really based off of residency. So where you are physically, unfortunately, does dictate what you can and cannot do with regards to your money. So, and the onus falls primarily on the financial institution. They need to be adequately licensed to take direction from a customer where they physically reside. And unfortunately, a lot of the American institutions are not licensed to take direction from Canadian residents and vice versa.
Now, here in Canada, if you withdraw money from your RRSP, they don't give you all the money that you withdraw. They hold some back. How does that work in the US?
Pretty similar in nature. So withholding taxes would be applicable. Now, this is why it's extremely important to get this done correctly is Canada and the United States do have a longstanding treaty, and I'm going to preface by saying I'm not a tax professional, I'm not a CPA, so don't take this as tax advice, but because of that longstanding treaty, a lot of Canadian residents, if you're American abroad, you have the ability to apply the treaty amount of withholding tax, should you choose to. So there are, it's important to get a lot of this documentation done correctly, and if you're kind of trying to do what I refer to as a duct tape solution, you may not necessarily be able to do that, or the documentation on the financial institution side might not match up correctly for what you have.
It is not the easiest thing to just, you know, put the cash in those investment accounts in a carry-on and cross at the border in Buffalo. How does one think through when and how to repatriate funds that have been invested in the U.S.?
So that's a really great question. And I think a lot of it comes down to just a little bit of forward-looking. You know, ideally, people are doing things in advance of their departure from their country. So I guess when you first decide that you want to move, that's probably the best time for a person to start addressing whether or not, okay, what happens to my money? It's typically an afterthought. So unfortunately, once you move, what's kind of done is done at that point. So it's very important to get ahead of it. And then kind of being mindful of what assets need to move, what assets can stay, and then whether or not you should move certain things or not. So there's a lot of things that you can do that doesn't necessarily mean that's something that you should do.
We talk about asset allocation. We also increasingly are talking about asset location because, you know, where you have your fixed income versus your equities and tax treatment here in Canada, that matters, especially if people have got all three. They've got an RRSP, a TFSA, and a non-registered account. What wisdom would you have on asset location if someone has investments in the US?
If you have assets in the United States, you want to be mindful of where you currently reside. So if this, in this example, if you reside in Canada and you have assets south of the border, then in that case, you want to be aware of, number one, from a regulation standpoint, you're legally entitled to keep a lot of your retirement accounts. You just need to be with the financial institution and advisory team that is allowed to keep you. So that's point number one. You can actually keep your retirement accounts. Only collapse them if you feel that that's prudent from a financial and wealth planning standpoint, and that's a separate discussion to have with yourself and your financial professional team. So that's kind of point number one that you want to just be wary and mindful of is, should I move it? And then the other point is, do I have to move it? And I think that's another really important one, and that's where some of those duct tape solutions do end up coming into play, where, for example, non-retirement accounts, I'll use the analogy, that's like luggage and you can't fly without it. It has to go with you to country of residence. So if you were an American and you moved to Canada, you actually have your non-retirement accounts are supposed to be at a Canadian domicile financial institution. And most people aren't aware that that actually has to happen. So there's what you should do, and then there's what you have to do. And it's just sort of parsing which ones need to be done.
What about in terms of asset class? So if you've got retirement savings in Canada, retirement savings in the US, should your US funds be in, you know, I don't know, a fixed income ETF, and in Canada it should be in equities? Like, how do you think about that overall asset allocation question?
So it really needs to be mindful of how that fits into your overall planning. So assuming you've done a thorough financial plan and you figured out what the appropriate mix is for your risk tolerance, your time horizon, and a lot of the other variables, If it's within a retirement account, then that's where you want to take a step back and look at it more holistically. And are there advantages for having, for example, some certain assets that would potentially create interest income inside of a retirement account? That's usually a good idea. That way you can try to shelter some of that, what could potentially be not as favorable tax treatment on some of that income that is deferred. Also, potentially, if you have some higher growth type securities that you're looking to do, having that be in sort of a tax exempt account, like a TFSA in Canada or a Roth in the United States, is another strategy. But a lot of it has to go as how do the pieces fit in the whole puzzle? Mm-hmm. So taking a step back and looking at not just how your geographical allocation looks like in the United States, but taking into account Canadian as well, and having that planning done from both aspects is very important.
What is the top most critical border blunder you would recommend people not make?
I'd say getting professional help. So I always say with this, it's kind of universal, regardless of anywhere in your life. Like, people hire a professional to do something when you don't have the time, energy, willingness, or expertise to do it yourself. So getting help when you think you need it, or when you're feeling a little bit overwhelmed, is probably the single most important thing. And that goes for what I do with my financial matters when I'm moving. It similarly for your tax situations. Americans abroad, unfortunately, have to do things a little bit differently. And it is a little bit more complicated than your standard conventional Canadian would be. And on that same token, and I would say it's almost an extension of that, being mindful that, you know, you're dealing with appropriate specialists that are capable of helping you. And that's probably an equally important point, because there's a whole saying that, you know, if you're a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail really quickly. And the issue is that a lot of professionals will just say, oh, that the same rule that applies in my jurisdiction will apply in another one. And that actually couldn't be further from the truth. And that's, I think, where people tend to get in a little bit of trouble.
Shiraz, thank you for your insight today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Shiraz Ahmed is founder of the Sartorial Wealth Team, part of Raymond James. He was here to talk about avoiding border blunders if you're someone who has investment accounts in both Canada and the U.S. Well, that is our show for today. Thanks to our sponsor, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you want to get a hold of us for any reason, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. You can send us your comments, your questions, your story ideas, all those sorts of things. And subscribe to the podcast version of this show on any of the podcast platforms that you have. Listen to podcasts on social media. I am at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.